From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, a look inside today's Army with Washington Post defense correspondent George Wilson. For his new book, Wilson spent a year with an infantry unit to see if the volunteer Army really lets you be all that you can be. David Kale did a laxative commercial in Woody Allen's film Radio Days, but he's better known as an up-and-coming performance artist. Coming up, a short performance by and interview with David Kale. Blues singer John Hammond joins us, and critic-at-large Laurie Stone has a review of New York singer Alva Rogers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. History was made today when three Soviet warships steamed into port at Norfolk, Virginia Naval Station, part of a five-day goodwill visit. Meanwhile, in Washington, Marshal Sergei Akhramayev appeared before the House Armed Services Committee. We get more from NPR's Ann Gerrels.
What seemed to preoccupy Akhramayev the most was U.S. naval strength, a subject he returned to again and again. Akhramayev warned that if the U.S. won't negotiate cuts in naval forces, arms control in other areas may be blocked. In what appeared to be a detailed accounting of Soviet armed forces, Akhramayev said the Soviet military spending is 77 billion rubles, half the U.S. estimate. Akhramayev suggested the discrepancy is a result of cheaper Soviet weapons, cheaper Soviet raw materials because prices are fixed, and cheaper Soviet labor. And he countered Western estimates that tank production has increased this year to 4,000, saying production is in fact down to 1,700. The Soviet marshal's appearance is just one of a series of exchanges now planned. The Armed Services Committee goes to Moscow in August, and today Akhramayev invited a member of the U.S. military to testify before the new Soviet Congress. I'm Ann Gerrels in Washington.
Rescue officials say they have recovered 109 bodies from the wreckage of United Airlines Flight 232. They will lift part of the DC-10 in an effort to find two more victims. State medical examiner Thomas Bennett said an autopsy would be performed on all the bodies recovered to determine the cause of death and to ease family concerns.
It is so important to know the locations of the bodies. They removed everyone they could. But at this point, location of people is so important. Where they are in the crash scene, where they are in the crash site. If nothing else, it gives you a clue about where they were seated in the plane. And that can give you a clue about who they were.
Investigators from the National Transportation Safety Board began measuring the tail section from the shattered plane in the search for clues to the cause of the crash. Iowa State Bar Association sent a special team to monitor the conduct of lawyers at the crash site. Ed Hansel is president of the Iowa State Bar Association. He says the lawyers will monitor any unethical conduct at the disaster scene.
Lawyers are not supposed to contact victims of disasters such as this. They're not supposed to make in-person or telephone solicitations of legal business under our code of professional responsibility. And also they're, of course, not supposed to pay other persons to make those types of contact.
The first lawsuit in the crash has already been filed. Survivor Joseph Trembolo is charged United Airlines with negligence in testing and design of the engine and hydraulic system of the DC-10. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose just under 32 points today to close at 2607.36. Advances and declines were about even on volume of 175 million shares. This is NPR News. President Bush sent his clean air package to Congress today. Bush said he hopes his plan will break the gridlock over clean air legislation. Environmentalists suggest it might not. They say the bill does not do much to improve the nation's deteriorating air quality. Democratic Senator Max Baucus, who co-sponsored the Senate clean air legislation, said the final language of Bush's bill will significantly tarnish his image as the environmental president. The Utah Fusion Energy Advisory Council today voted unanimously to release up to $4.5 million to the University of Utah for more cold fusion experiments. Ann Burnett of member station KUER reports the funding will depend on final approval from the state's budget. The House today approved more than $14 billion in foreign aid. The bill provides military and economic assistance and contributions to international organizations. The House earlier made a 1% across-the-board cut in the bill and passed an amendment expressing the hope that Congress and Israel will open schools on the occupied West Bank as soon as possible and will not use schools for political purposes. One child was killed and six other people were injured when a car bomb exploded in the Afghan capital of Kabul today. Kabul Radio blamed the attack on Western-backed Mujahideen guerrillas. Campbell Soup shares rose today on rumors of an $80 a share buyout offer. The rumors did not identify potential suitors. Campbell has been the target of recurring takeover speculation since stockholder John Dorrance died in April. His heirs hold 58% of Campbell's stock. There was a sharp rise on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose almost 32 points to close at 2607.36. Advances were ahead of declines, and volume was 175 million shares. The average price of a share rose 20 cents. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. Since July 1973, the United States has had a volunteer army. My guest, George Wilson, has studied the new volunteer army from the inside to see who is joining and if the soldiers and officers have the willingness, skill, and leadership to hold in a war. For 1 year, he lived off and on with new professional soldiers, following them from basic training at Fort Benning, Georgia, to Fort Riley's Charlie Company. Wilson's new book is called Mud Soldiers. He says that's a term of affectionate respect for the infantrymen who have it hardest and die soonest in most of our wars. Wilson is the chief defense correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the books The Army in Anguish and Supercarrier, for which he spent 7 months living inside the steel walls of an aircraft carrier. He wrote Mud Soldiers after Army generals told him that no one was writing about the new volunteer army.
I couldn't do the whole army, of course, but I thought the spear point of it, the rifle companies that go first, die first, have to be ready, would be the most meaningful assessment as to how we stand now in this experiment that we've been conducting since 1973 of eliminating the draft and going for an all-volunteer army.
When America switched to a volunteer army, one of the fears was that the army would be comprised of the uneducated and the poor. So I'm wondering if that's actually happened, and you know, who are, from what you've seen, who are the new volunteers, and what are their motivations for joining the Army?
Well, most of them are the have-nots of our society. They're the non-establishment teenagers who don't have the easy access to a job with their father's company or money in a bank for college. But they're not the uneducated, because more than 90% of today's Army has his high school diploma. And they score pretty high on the tests, the ones that they're accepting, the so-called Category 1s and Category 2s. But having said all that, they very often come from broken homes, and the Army, in some cases, is their first home. And they're joining because they've looked around at their options at their hometowns, and they said, look, I don't want to work at the local plywood factory or flip hamburgers at McDonald's. The Army sounds like it'd be kind of fun, and it looks like a step up for me.
Are today's young men in the Army less fit on the whole than they were when there was a draft? In other words, does the Army have to take who it can get and make accommodations?
Well, I was in Vietnam in 68 and 72, and I spent a fair amount of time with rifle units. And I have to say that I was not worried about the troops holding and dying for their country then, and I'm not worried about the troops holding and dying for their country today. The soldiers are much more on top of what they're supposed to learn as soldiers than is the middle management, the sergeants and young officers. We've gotten back to this ticket-punching system where the officers don't stay in their job long enough to get good at it. It's kind of like a quarterback who does spring practice, goes to the Super Bowl, and then he's on to another profession. A guy only has a rifle company for a year, year and a half, and then he goes on to punch his ticket by going to a war college. And out in the desert, I saw us lose battle after battle, and it was not the troops' fault, not the volunteer soldiers' fault. It was the officers, basically, didn't know what they were doing. Again, through no fault of the officers, it's just a system that doesn't let them stay in command long enough to master the intricacies. And I tell you, running a rifle company in high-speed warfare of today takes a lot of practice, and we're not giving it to these middle management sergeants and officers. We used to leave guys with their rifle units and platoons for 3 years. we've gotten away from that. Now everybody's supposed to be a Renaissance man, and the kids are paying the price because they're having officers that don't know their skills.
Let's get back to the troops. There was also a fear that there wouldn't be enough volunteers to fill the Army. You say the tide turned in the 1980s.
That's right.
What changed in the 1980s?
Well, a lot of things happened at once. First of all, the pay got better. The GI Bill got restored so that if you signed up tomorrow morning for 4 years in the Army, you'd have $25,000 roughly when you got out. And I have to say that there was the poison in the well that we had in Vietnam disappeared, and Ronald Reagan, if he did nothing else, reasserted this kind of patriotism, the sense of pride in the military, and things turned around, plus just time. I mean, you have to remember that the Tet Offensive in Vietnam was 1968. That was before most of today's soldiers were born. And the hero drill instructor, if you believe it or not, at Fort Benning when I went through with these young volunteers was a rifle leader from the Grenada, which, you know, to you and me is probably just a minor little operation. But to a guy 18, 19, that was his war.
Would you explain what the financial benefits are and other benefits that accrue to soldiers who volunteer for the Army?
All right. If you joined a combat arm tomorrow morning, in other words, infantry or artillery or some of those specialties which do the actual fighting as opposed to working in a hospital or a computer center, you would get, as a private, you'd get about $650 a month for starting pay. But more importantly, if you finished your training successfully, you'd get your $5,000 bonus for signing up for a combat arm. And if you joined the put-away program for your college, you'd get $25,000 roughly at the end of 4 years in a kind of updated GI Bill to put towards college. And there's other college benefits, but those are the main ones. And when young men look around and see their options, they think that this is a better deal than they can get around home in many cases. Plus the fact that there's security, you know, the jobs are there. You don't get laid off as an infantry rifleman. So in many communities of this country, that's a better future than one can get in the private sector. And then also you've got something on your resume to show an employer that, look, I did 4 years in the Army and I was here, there, and the other place. And most of the guys I talked to after 1 year said that the biggest benefit was not so much the skills in the sense of translating them to the civilian sector, but it made them kind of grow up and see a lot of the country and learn about different people than they would have if they'd stayed home and been more comfortable.
I see all the Be All You Can Be campaign commercials on television. How effective have they been?
They've been effective. The problem is that it sets them up for disillusionment. The young men and women do join thinking that this really is an opportunity to be all you can be. And they keep that motivation through basic training and advanced individual training, which is roughly a 4-month process. Then they report to their unit, and it's kind of business as usual. And too often the officers and sergeants treat them as draftees with no rights and kind of waste their time. And it's a big letdown. And they're wondering, gee, I can't be all I can be. So some of them hang in there and, you know, go through the motions of being a soldier. But I have to tell you that a lot of air comes out of the balloon because we're not imagined enough to keep up this motivation. I mean, these guys joined because they thought they were getting somewhere. And if you fail to show the light at the end of their tunnel, they just give up on themselves and the Army and everything else. And it's tough in peacetime. We have no enemy at the gate. We have no war to get ready for. So how do you keep it interesting out there in the plains of Fort Riley? Well, my answer is, how do you keep teaching your algebra and geometry to high school students interesting? You have to be a good leader. You have to be imaginative. But we're falling down badly on that.
My guest is George Wilson. He's the chief defense correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the new book, Mud Soldiers, Life Inside the New American Army. What about soldiers with wives and children? And there really are a lot of married soldiers now in the volunteer army. How do the families do? How do the wives feel about the way they're treated?
Well, we really are going through a social revolution in all the military services. First of all, you have women in uniform. You have more married soldiers than you ever did before. They don't live in open bay barracks like they used to. They live in individual rooms like a dormitory. And so the women that I got to know the best in following this rifle company for a year were wives of very junior enlisted people, you know, privates, private first class, and they were really up against it economically, and their husbands were in the field all the time. So living in a trailer in Junction City, Kansas, and having a little baby and not seeing your husband except for weekends, if that, and kind of scraping to get by wasn't exactly glamorous. And when they go to Germany, the living isn't too easy either. Now, in fairness to the Army, they warn these young soldiers that, look, living off the economy is going to be tough, but, you know, human beings are human beings, and they like to bring their wives with them. But it's a tough struggle for the enlisted man's wives until their husbands get some rank, you know, like sergeant and above.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the drill instructors during basic training. Are they still, for the most part, in the style of, say, Lew Gossett in Officer and a Gentleman?
Well, there's a lot of that on the surface, but I have to tell you that I had covered some Marine abuse trials, Bubba McClure, who was beaten to death while his drill sergeant looked on, and I was familiar with Sergeant McCune, who marched his troops into Ribbon Creek and Paris Island and drowned some of them. So I came in there thinking that these guys were really bullies, but I have to say that after watching them day after day, week after week at Fort Benning, the drill instructors are pretty sensitive to the needs of these guys, and they're not by any means coddling them. But the one thing that drill instructors can do that most adults could not do while these guys were growing up was they can perform the missions that they are asking their troops to do. And it's very impressive for a drill instructor to do all the exercises, run with the guys for 3 miles, stay with them from dawn till dark. I mean, these guys work 16 hours a day and 7 days a week, certainly 6 days. And so I asked each of these troopers, after they'd finished basic training, what they thought of the drill instructors. If they had it to do over again, would they go through this agony of, you know, being terrorized in the beginning and then being very firmly controlled later? And most of them were very fond of the drill instructors and thought they had done them an awful lot of good. Now, having said that, and saying that the drill instructors most of the time are heroes to their charges, there are some guys who can't handle that kind of discipline. And we had 4 attempted suicides in this company of 200 trainees that I watched very closely. None of the suicide attempts was successful. But a guy who was a loner in high school, can't relate to his peers, and can't take orders, and can't adjust, you know, the Army's not for him.
Since, you mentioned this example of 4 suicides, do you think that there should be a way out for volunteers if after, as soon as a few weeks or a couple of months, they decide they made the really wrong choice?
Well, that's one of my strongest recommendations in the book, is that we provide exit options for people who enlist. But again, the suicide attempts are referred to professional counselors, and of those 4 attempts, 3 of the 4 were indeed discharged from the Army. So it's not as though they're insensitive to it once it occurs, but it's always a fine line for the poor old drill instructor who's got a million things to worry about. Is this guy faking, or is he really mean it? And you know, everybody threatens to jump out windows. Are these guys really going to do it? And you're asking the drill instructor to be a doctor, a psychiatrist, a chaplain. But at any rate, they do have a way to get rid of misfits. But my point is that if I'm a 17-year-old and I signed up for the Army Infantry for 4 years, I probably didn't really know what it was going to be like. I didn't know what I was doing. And I think there should be an exit window at, say, the halfway mark of my 4-year enlistment, so that if I really don't like this man's Army, I'll put in my 2 years, I've done the country some good, I'm trained as an apprentice infantryman, but I don't have to go through misery if that's what it's become. And we offer that option to West Point cadets with no penalty. So I say, why not give it to the grunts and save all this legal business of chaptering misfits out? I mean, guys at Fort Riley who just couldn't hack the Army any longer after graduating from Fort Benning resorted to such things as jumping out windows, going back on drugs just to get themselves kicked out. I say, let's save all that pain, and anybody who doesn't want to be in there isn't really doing the outfit much good.
Well, let's talk more about the new volunteer Army after we take a short break. My guest is George Wilson. He's the chief defense correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the new book, Mud Soldiers. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest, George Wilson, is the author of Mud Soldiers, Life Inside the New American Army. To get the story of the volunteer army, Wilson lived with a rifle company of new recruits while they went through basic training. Then he followed them for about a year. He's also the author of the bestseller Super Carrier. You were telling us a little earlier that you really had a higher regard for the soldiers than for the officers. And I'm going to ask you now to elaborate on that, to elaborate on the shortcomings in the officers and in the system that creates officers in the volunteer army.
Well, it's not in terms of personal regard. I have high regard for both the officers and the enlisted soldiers. My point, however, is that we don't allow our officers to get good at their trade. In other words, for me to be a really good platoon leader or a really good company commander and know how to deploy aircraft, how to defend against tanks, how to use missiles that are behind me, how to get my troops so that they don't go running up against a wood line and get themselves killed, takes a lot of practice, a lot of skills, a lot of time at this intricate ballet, which is a rifle company in action.
You suggest that officers go back through basic training with soldiers.
Right. I also don't like the fact that there doesn't seem to be any recognition in the middle management that these guys really did believe that they joined the Army to be all they can be, and they do have dreams, and they're not just draftees who are marking their time, and all they care about is three hots and a cot, as I used to say. They really have some ambitions. But the only way I can figure out to convince these officers that they're dealing with a different breed of soldier is to immerse them in the stress environment of basic training. Also, frankly, the officers would learn a lot about the basic skills of running through woods and taking on ambushers. So my proposal is, okay, after you've gotten your commission as a green second lieutenant from either West Point or an ROTC college, go down there at Fort Benning or wherever, and go through basic training for 7 weeks with the troops. No favors, no bars on your shoulders. And you'll know after hours by talking to your fellow soldiers what they're about, why they're in the Army, what they expect of you. And then you can reestablish the firebreak after that 7 weeks. I don't think it would kill anybody. It would be immensely helpful in letting these officers know what kind of soldiers they're going to be commanding.
Let's look at some of the weapons in the Army today. One of the ones you talk about you think is a disgrace. It's called the Dragon, and you think it's a disgrace that foot soldiers should have to lug this thing around. Would you describe it and why you don't like it?
Right. Well, first of all, it's a missile that you fire out of a long tube, and to fire it, you've got to sit underneath it. It's kind of on your lap, and then there's a little tripod out there. But what really enrages me about the Dragon is, and I was there as the sergeants were instructing the troops how to use it, is that they say, look, you've got to keep the crosshairs on the oncoming tank twice as long as it takes the tank to find and kill you. And you can't move and duck in a hole after you pull the trigger. You just got to sit there out there in the open field, because if you try and get down the foxhole, the wire that trails out behind the missile will get tangled or it'll hit a lake and short circuit. So you got to, in effect, sit out there and risk suicide.
In terms of defense, we've spent so much money in the past few years on the big high-tech items, nuclear missiles, nuclear silos, super carriers. Do you think that a disproportionate amount of money is going to the super high-tech stuff and perhaps not enough to the troops and to the weapons that the troops would use?
Right. I think the infantryman has gotten low priority. I mean, what do we use when we try to make a point? We don't use the stealth bomber, and we can't use the missiles. We send good old-fashioned troops down to Panama. We send good old-fashioned troops to Grenada. We send troops in to try and rescue American hostages. Sure, we need a given number of high-tech weapons to build deterrence. If you fire at us, we can do worse to you, kind of a deterrent posture. But it seems to me that this country should make sure that the troops that are most likely to go to war first, be the point of the spear, ought to be the best equipped. I mean, the radio's still cut out all the time. I mean, we were in the desert at night, and there was always problems with the radios. I don't know whether it's doomed to be ever so, but it just seems to me we ought to at least have a reliable radio to start with.
Are you concerned about whether there's enough money in the defense budget now for the volunteer army to pay the troops?
Well, no, I don't. That's not my big fear. My fear is more the priority, how we divide up the money pie. I mean, like it or not, right or wrong, we are restructuring the American military today by subtraction after years of addition. And if Bush and Gorbachev can work it out, the Army's going to get smaller and smaller. Currently, it's half the size of the Vietnam Army. It's about 760,000 today. It was 1.5 million in 68 at the height of the Vietnam War. So if it's going to be smaller, and I have no problem with that, I think the idea is to bring peace to the world. If it's going to be smaller, it's got to be awfully good.
Let's look at some of your recommendations for the Army. You recommend, and this is interesting, that training should be more fun.
Yeah. These guys, I mean, who's going to join the infantry today? You know, you're cold, you're wet, you can make more money probably and go home at night and have a beer. It's a guy who wants some adventure, who wants to be a little bit of a Rambo, who thinks it, again, as we said earlier, that he's going to get somewhere, but he doesn't want to be bored to death doing it. But so often we just let these guys sit around out there in their units. And this isn't just in Fort Riley where I happen to focus. I've been getting letters from all over the country since the book came out of officers decrying the fact that the system doesn't allow them to be imaginative. And somehow we've gotten this workaholic syndrome of everybody's got to be out pretending they're training even if there's nothing meaningful to do. I don't care if they work a half day and then swim and play basketball. That's part of being fit. And I think you've got to keep up the enthusiasm in the military. And standing out in the rain, having a sergeant read out of a field manual, which I saw for myself time after time, that's not the way to make it fun for guys who, you know, join the infantry for some adventure.
I guess the bottom line question is, do you think that the volunteer army inspires confidence?
Well, I think it's a good army. I just think it could be a much better army. I mean, we're asking a lot of the army to be at a fever pitch in peacetime, and it's a real challenge for the leadership. But I have to say that we should recognize that it's a thin red line, that it's a small army, that the draft is coming back as soon as we get, if we get, in any kind of a substantial conflict, even as small as Vietnam, because there's so few trigger pullers in the active duty army that they can go out and they'll hold, but then we've got to activate the reserves. The reserves are not going to be draft dodging haven anymore if we get in any kind of a major conflict. And then the draft has to get cranked up. And this seed corn army we've got out here has got to train the raw kids off the streets. So we've got to keep our training base hot, but we've also got to make sure that this volunteer army is small and, you know, help it be all it can be.
Well, George Wilson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, enjoyed it.
George Wilson's book, Mud Soldiers, Life Inside the New American Army, is published by Scribner's. Wilson is the chief defense correspondent for The Washington Post. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, exploding heads and decaying limbs, when I talk with special effects director Chris Wallace. Wallace did the special effects for films such as Scanners and The Fly. He also directed Fly 2, which is about to come out on home video. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. David Cale's performance piece Red Throats is about an alienated, lonely, working-class boy who spends his time alone in his room singing along with Judy Garland records. Cale himself wanted to be a singer, but he wound up one of the new crop of performance artists. Coming up, David Cale performs excerpts of Red Throats and Smooch Music and talks with us about his work. We also have a performance from blues singer and guitarist John Hammond. And critic at large Laurie Stone introduces us to singer Alva Rogers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. President Bush today sent his Clean Air Plan to Congress. Bush claims his legislative package will achieve major cuts in air pollution while giving industry sufficient flexibility to minimize emission control costs.
Around the world, in efforts to clean up the environment, we, the United States of America, are taking the lead. And the next step now is congressional action.
But Senator Max Baucus of Montana isn't very impressed with the proposal.
Well, it certainly seems to be a pattern of a very bold, strong statement, not followed up by bold, strong action. It seems to be that the words are loud, but the action is weak. But it's up to us in the Congress to help make up the difference.
Critics charge the plan has been so watered down by industry compromises that it will not fulfill cleanup promises and will actually weaken current law. The Bush administration continued its efforts to get congressional approval for the B-2 stealth bomber today. The president met with doubting House Republicans, and a team of generals went to Capitol Hill to convince senators that a vote against the B-2 would jeopardize arms control talks with the Soviets. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Air Force Chief of Staff Larry Welch told the Senate Armed Services Committee that without the B-2, U.S. arms control negotiators would have to reformulate their entire position at the START talks. Today, President Bush told Congress members that a vote against the B-2 would be devastating to arms control efforts. Some Congress members bristled at that equation. Colorado Senator Tim Wirth accused the Pentagon of playing a game of high-stakes poker when it said to Congress, if you want arms talks, you have to have the B-2. The B-2 is the most expensive plane ever planned. Each one will cost $530 million. Its price tag is proving to be too big for Congress to accept. Congress and the administration agreed earlier this year to cut $10 billion out of the Pentagon budget. Now, many members of Congress are eyeing the stealth as a good place to cut. Several amendments that reduce, slow down, or cancel the stealth program will be debated next week when both houses of Congress take up the defense budget. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
The House today approved a $14.2 billion foreign aid appropriations bill. The spending plan provides military and economic aid for countries around the world and contributions to international organizations. The measure provides $5.5 billion for military aid programs in the fiscal 1990 year starting October 1st. Iran's top civil aviation authority says it may consider accepting the U.S. offer for compensation for the 1988 downing of an Iranian jetliner, but first wait till the international court rules. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up today 31.87 points. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Blues musician John Hammond joins us today for our weekly performance spot. He's the son of the late record producer John Hammond. This John Hammond has been playing the blues ever since he was 14 when he got his first guitar. Later, he added the harmonica. His repertoire includes many blues songs from the 20s and 30s, and Hammond says he's continually amazed at the variation of blues styles. Today he's going to give us a sampling of the musicians and songs that influenced his harmonica playing.
My inspiration for the harmonica, came from watching Jimmy Reed play, seeing a guy playing with a harmonica and a rack around his neck and just playing all these great tunes. And
don't you know that I love you? honest I do, baby. Ain't nobody, baby, I'd ever place above you. Please tell me you love me. Stop driving me mad. 'Cause you're the sweetest little woman that I ever, ever had.
Another harmonica player who was one of the greatest that ever lived was Sonny Terry. And he began playing with Blind Boy Fuller. And they made a bunch of records together in North Carolina in the 30s. And one of them goes something like this.
Baby, my cork's on top. How in the world gonna lose, honey, with the help I got?
Another of the great harmonica players that had a big influence on me and who I just learned so many songs of was Little Walter, Marion Jacobs, somebody who influenced just about every harmonica player that's going now in terms of blues. And this is one of his tunes, and it's Move On Up the Line.
Love me, set all your heart desire. You're acting strange lately, trying to die my love away. I'm cutting out. Girl, I move on up the line. 'Cause if I stay another day, you're gonna drive me out of my mind. Well, you took me from my home. I was nothing but a child. Made me all those promises, honey, just a line of jive. I'm cutting out. Baby, I'll move on up the line. Come on, honey, now. 'Cause if I stay another day, you're gonna drive me out of my mind. Took me from my home, I was nothing but a child. Made me all those promises, honey, just a line of jive. I'm cutting out.
John Hammond will join us again later in the summer to play slide guitar. His new album, Nothing But You, is on the Flying Fish record label. This is Fresh Air. David Cale is a British-born monologist who emerged from the same New York downtown performance scene that Spalding Gray and Eric Bogosian established themselves in. 2 years ago in the New York Times, Stephen Holden described David Cale's material this way: reality, fantasy, and an almost clairvoyant insight into personality dissolve into one another in stories that can be as memorable as one's own most vivid dreams. Cale has toured nationally and has appeared in the films Radio Days and Moon Over Parador. Two of Cale's full-length pieces, Red Throats and Smooch Music, have been published in book form. Smooch Music is a series of vignettes about romance and love in contemporary New York. Red Throats is about a withdrawn boy who spends most of his time alone in his room singing along to Judy Garland records. David Cale performed a scene for us between the boy Stephen and his teacher.
Meanwhile at school, Stephen was being interviewed. "Sit down, Stephen," said Mr. Whitlock. "Now, have you any idea what you want to do when you leave school?"
"Yes, Mr. Whitlock."
"What, Stephen?"
"I'm going to be a legend."
"What's that?"
"It's the superstar that people never forget."
"I see. Well, you'll be the only legend living in Littleton."
"I'm not going to live in Littleton, Mr. Whitlock. I'm going to live in America. All the legends live in America."
"Oh, they do they, Stephen? And who in your estimation is a legend?"
"Judy Garland. I'm going to be like Judy Garland."
"But Judy Garland is a woman, Stephen."
"I know she is."
"Stephen, I think you should try accountancy."
"Why?"
"I just think you should. Yes, accountancy would be fine."
"Accountancy?" muttered Stephen as he left the room. "Accountancy? Yuck!"
And as soon as he got home from school, he ran up to his room and started singing Swanee.
Thank you, David Cale. You actually tried to make it as a singer yourself, didn't you, before becoming a performance artist?
I did work for a few years with a rock band, and then I started writing songs, and that developed into my reading the songs, the words, at poetry readings. And then gradually the little spoken songs turned into monologues and then longer, more theatrical pieces and stories.
When you started performing, did you know you had it in you to do different voices?
No. I just sort of did it instinctively, that when I was playing different, when I was writing about different people, I would just sort of put on little voices. And then I started working on it more consciously. And certainly the Red Throats has, I guess it has 20-something characters in it or something. So it had to be very defined, I mean, for when it's done on the stage, because the version on the stage is different to the book in the sense of the book makes it clear which characters are speaking, whereas on the stage I just do the voices, and that has to carry it.
Red Throats is also about an adolescent growing up in a family called the Weird Family. That's their last name, Weird.
Yeah.
Did you grow up in a family that, in your mind, was the Weird Family?
No. I mean, any resemblance to an autobiography is very much kind of removed and heightened, and I've let my imagination go on the facts, so to speak. But I was interested in trying to write about someone who turns into themselves by the end of or realizes that they're special by the end of the piece.
There's a woman in Red Throats who says, "You know what they say: if you're born in Littleton, you die in Littleton."
Yes.
Were you desperate to get out of the place that you were born in?
Yeah.
Where was
it? Yeah, I mean, I was born in a town called Luton, which is it's very parallel to the town in the Red Throats. It's a very sort of industrial, small town that revolves around a car factory, basically, and it's very close to London. But people would never go to London, and certainly it's an old saying in the town that if you're born there, you die there, and that generally is the case, that people don't leave.
So how did you get out? Had you plotted your escape for a long time?
No, I just left.
What did you do?
I just got on the train and left. And coming to America was, I mean, looking back on it, it was extremely naive in the sense that I just got on a plane with a small bag and never went back.
On the plane, the character who's headed towards the United States says, "I'm being taken over by me, the me..."
The me I haven't been yet.
Yeah.
The me I'm going to be when I start being myself.
Exactly. Does that describe your feelings?
I don't know. I guess so, yeah. I like the idea of someone having a change of life on a plane in the middle of the sky. And I also like the idea of a personality or someone being taken over by their true personality.
I like that too, because it's a nice variation on reinventing yourself. It's not changing yourself. It's letting yourself be who you wanted to be all along, who you've been all along, but that you had to suppress.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, I mean, the peak of the piece is this young boy sort of taking his life in his hands and just shaking it till all these bad parts fall out of it. And he becomes himself. But this happens in the clouds.
David, would you do a reading of the second piece that's reprinted in your book, Smooch Music?
Sure. This is the first part of a section in Smooch Music, which is called "Talking to You on the Phone is Better Than Being With You." On the corner of 81st Street and 1st Avenue, there's a phone booth. And sometimes, if you're walking past the phone booth at night, the phone will start ringing. Just as you're walking past, it'll ring. And if you pick it up, there'll be a woman's voice on the other end, and she'll say, "Hi, my name's Honey. I just stepped out of the shower. I'm naked as a seashell, dripping everywhere. You want to talk a while? You want Honey to give you her number? You want to run home? Call Honey from the comfort of your own home? Or you want to talk to Honey's friend Joe? Joe will do whatever you want on the phone. You want a J-O with Joe? Or you want to have a three-way with Honey and Joe? Honey has two extensions in her apartment. You could talk to both of us at once. Or you could talk to Honey and Honey's friend Kathy. Kathy could come over. Two sexy girls at the same time. Or you could talk to Honey and Kathy and Joe. And we could get Joe's friend Pedro to come over and speak a little Spanish."
What inspired that one?
There is a phone on at that very junction that rings. Well, I've been past it and it started ringing, but I've never picked it up. So the rest is my imagination.
After writing this, you still weren't tempted to pick it up?
Now I would pick it up.
You've told us that you think a lot of what you do is intuitive. And I get the impression that what you're doing is not anything you ever planned to do, but something that you had in you and that slowly evolved out of stuff that you were doing before.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what I found is I just worked a lot. Mm-hmm. And without any kind of overall view of what was happening, I was just putting these little pieces together, and they gradually got longer, and then a theatre would book them, and then gradually things got more involved, but it was quite unconscious. And it continues to, if I hold on to my instincts. But
is that hard to do as you get better known and as you get cast in other people's movies?
It gets. I found that things get more complicated as there's more attention paid to what I do. That it would be easy for a certain self-consciousness to creep in, which I won't allow, or for it to be maneuvered in a certain direction which was more commercial or more to a certain person's taste. I mean, it's harder to hold on to your instincts.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
And for performing as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Two of David Kale's performance pieces are published by Vintage in the book Red Throats. Kale is currently performing three new works in progress at PS 122 in New York. To be among the folks in DIX, I even know my mammy's waiting for me, praying for me down by the Swanee. The folks up north will see me no more when I get to that Swanee shore.
This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
We have continuing coverage of the investigation into the crash of a United DC-10 in Sioux City, Iowa. Also, some advice on how to be able to choose the aircraft you would like to fly the next time you call the airlines or your travel agent. And we'll talk with Tom Friedman of the New York Times. He's the author of a new book about the conflicts in Lebanon and in Jerusalem. Friedman won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting from Beirut, another Pulitzer Prize for his work from Jerusalem as a New York Times correspondent. He'll tell us how the 1982 invasion of Lebanon played an important role in the Palestinian uprising, the Intifada, that started in 1987.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic at large Laurie Stone has been following the career of a young singer named Alva Rogers, who she'd like to introduce us to.
Alva Rogers can spoof any music form, gospel, funk, rhythm and blues, Caribbean, yet she doesn't sound like anyone else. At 20-something, she's branding the air with a voice that can dig deep one moment, then lilt the next into achingly sweet harmonies.
A desert road from Vegas to Norway. Some place better than where you've been. A coffee machine that needs some fixing. In a little cafe just around the bend.
Rogers has staged shows at the New Museum and several small clubs in New York, together with accompanists and collaborators, Charles Burham on violin, Brandon Ross on guitar, and writer-director Lisa Jones. The group moves with a wave of young black artists who pay respect to cultural sources and at the same time declare their independence. They love the energy, sense of community, and warmth of bebop and R&B, but the performers also point up romantic, sanctifying attitudes. Their treatments are sometimes merely clever and intellectual, but for the most part they are tough-minded rather than sentimental, inquiring rather than reverent, self-defining rather than reactive, educated rather than folksy. Most satisfyingly, they are richly musical.
Ooh, I hear music in the air.
Which combine musical numbers and monologues, are tightly spun, with each vocal line and facial expression orchestrated. Rogers likes to vamp. She flashes the whites of her eyes, wiggles her slinky hips, and prods the air with gloved arms, but she controls the flirting, and she doesn't do torch songs. Her attitude about sexual romanticism is as sharp-witted as it is about race cliches.
I met a man one day, but he wasn't a man at all, no, no, he wasn't a man at all. He was a lost child. He tugged at my skirt and ran off the cliff like I was gonna follow him. I met
As smart as this singer is, it's her vibrant, electric vocalizing that keeps the juices flowing at her shows. She brings tears to your eyes, makes you sway and boogie. Her work is included on the A&M recording Live from the Knitting Factory, but she's ready for an album of her own and the large following that's sure to buy it.
Lori Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Fresh Air was produced this week by Danny Miller and Fred Landerl. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the exploding heads and melting flesh of Chris Wallace. He directed the sci-fi thriller The Fly 2, and he got his start making gruesome special effects for The Fly and Scanners. Also, we meet best-selling spy novelist Frederick Forsyth. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.